A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I'm Anoush.
And I'm Stephen.
Alva, our third co-presenter, is on holiday, but on this episode of the New Statesman podcast, the last of the year, we discuss the Christmas rules U-turn and speak about our plans for getting through the winter. So over the weekend, the Christmas plans in areas that have been moved into Tier 4 have been cancelled, and the idea of three households in a bubble over those 4 days of Christmas has also been cancelled. So Stephen, you were following the U-turn closely, and we've had a lot of questions from our listeners about it. You know, some of them are asking about the timing, so the announcement coinciding with this new strain and how concerned we should be about the new strain. Some are asking about what it says about Boris Johnson's leadership, and some are asking about Keir Starmer's response to it. Is this a case of the government sort of being caught on the back foot by a new development in the virus, and can we really condemn them for cancelling everyone's plans at such last minute?
Well, yes and no, right? So the identification of the new variant strain, which is more transmissible, although, of course, the thing you should always remember if you want to be optimistic about these kinds of things, which is also just true, right, isn't the peak evolutionary state of any virus is to be highly transmissible and not that deadly, right?
Yeah.
That is apex virushood. But so the mutation makes it more transmissible, which probably explains the thing we didn't quite understand, which is why the national lockdown didn't really appear to put a dent in the rise in cases in London in the way it did in the UK's other major cities. Now, lots of people, myself included, went, well, look, that's probably because London's the only sort of properly mega city in a UK context. Mm-hmm. You know, significantly larger than any of the others, has more key workers in it. You know, like, and that may, of course, also be part of the thing, but it probably slightly explains why it isn't the last lockdown didn't appear to work in London. But that crucially kind of also illustrates why, like, so yes, the moment when kind of scientists went, okay, yeah, we feel confident this is, yeah, because there'd be new mutations of COVID-19 throughout the year. The moment when scientists went, look, we're confident that this is a thing, we're confident that, you know, like, this does increase transmissibility, was the moment where the government did change its overall approach. Mm. But if this makes sense, it's a bit like if last week when I said, look, here are the problems of the Christmas unlocking, here are the risks, and we're going to call this problem Fred. And then the government went, oh my God, the problem's called Fred? Like, the problem of the Christmas unlocking was moving large numbers of cases from our great cities, all of which are net exporters of people over the Christmas period, to rural areas, semi-rural areas and towns, spreading that among older populations and overloading NHS capacity, right? That was always the problem of unlocking. Now, we now know that one of the reasons why that problem was particularly acute in London and the South East was a new COVID strain that needs a tougher set of lockdown measures to hopefully help slow its spread. Mm. But to be frank, when it looked that London's lockdown hadn't worked, the approach, right, particularly because I ultimately, like, if lockdown measures don't work, you can always undo them. If you don't try them, you can't undo having not tried them. Also, if you're going to do the Christmas unlocking, then you could not have a lockdown tier system based on healthcare capacity in those individual regions, right? So the reason why London was in Tier 2, although, of course, you can argue about what extent the government worked backwards from wanting to keep the engine room of the economy running as hot as possible, Downing Street wanting to sign with the Treasury, and to what extent that then informed going, okay, we'll use healthcare capacity, not caseload. But seeing as we were always planning to redistribute the caseload over the course of this travel window, so the new variant is serious. Mm. Yeah, we shouldn't be worried about it, but, you know, we should take it seriously. But equally, it is a bit like if you know, if you were like, oh, I'm planning to go out jogging with, like, gold line Beats by Dre and a £50 note trailing out my thing, I'd be like, Anoush, you're probably going to get mugged. And you then did it and you were like, oh, I got mugged at knife point. This is new information. It's like, well, okay, the knife is new information. But you should, but the structural risk did not change.
You don't know how fast I jog, Stephen. Yeah, no, I think that's a really fair assessment, isn't it? Because even though the new variant, if you look at the graphs, has been rising, you know, extremely fast, there's still the old variant, right? There's still the other variants that we have in the country that also rise when you lift the measures. So, like you say, that's not something that's new information that the government can't predict when it relaxes the rules, as has been happening with the sort of ebb and flow of the virus since it arrived. And I suppose it does sort of, it's the clearest indictment yet of the government's announcement of that Christmas loosening. We've spoken about it so often on the podcast and the different factors and forces that were behind it. But I do think it shows it up more than ever to have been a sort of terrible plan from the start with no real sort of redeeming features. And of course, if you do have to cancel people's plans last minute, even if your hand is forced by a new sort of factor that you weren't expecting, it still means that the reality of people's day-to-day lives is they've spent money on something, they've spent sort of emotional labour and hopes on something that they then have to cancel. And of course, that makes people feel bad and it makes them feel like the government hasn't got its act together, and it loses that very, very crucial goodwill that you need from people to take them through what's going to last, you know, yet longer and is going to be quite a painful time still, you know, even with the vaccines on the horizon. And then, yeah, another point about this new variant is that when you hear from scientists, they say that viruses do mutate all the time, and this variant does have a lot of different mutations, which makes it significant. But, you know, even if eventually there is a sort of strand of this virus that can evade the current vaccine that we have, that's no different from flu, really, because the vaccine changes its formulation each year, doesn't it, to catch up with the new strain. And these particular vaccines that are being rolled out are easy to tweak. So, you know, rather than being alarmist, then it would be helpful if that could be sort of at the forefront of the government's communications as well, sort of how it works in terms of the vaccine. But in terms of the politics, because we've had a lot of listeners asking questions about that, there was quite an interesting question from someone about why Boris Johnson didn't just reschedule Christmas, which is quite interesting. And someone else was asking about why Labour doesn't turn the Captain Hindsight attack line that they always use on Keir Starmer back onto the Conservatives, considering they've had to do so many U-turns. So how do you think each party is sort of coming out of this debacle?
I mean, to be honest, I would say I thought each party, you know, across all of the governing parties of the United Kingdom, so that is the Conservatives, the SNP, the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats, the latter two of whom are, of course, in office in Wales, and the SNP are, spoiler alert, in office in Scotland. I would say they have all come out of it pretty badly. I would say then the government... You know, this is really bringing home for me the argument for English devolution, because I keep wanting to use the phrase English government when I'm referring, of course, to the UK-wide government, because it is, of course, England's devolved government de facto. But, like, ultimately, I think, like, the first time I did a sort of, like, maybe Christmas unlocking is not a good idea because of everything we know about winter transmissibility, peaked on the NHS, etc., was when the government first started being like, oh, maybe we could unlock for Christmas in July, right? And that was something driven by the English government. And broadly, the reason why we ended up with this all UK accord is that none of the devolved governments wanted to be the ones to go, Christmas is cancelled. And in the context of the Northern Ireland executive, there's obviously the kind of added internal politics than broadly, because Ireland was doing its public information campaign. Mm. Aligning with that would have been fraught for some of the parties than make up the government. So England was, the English government, speaking colloquially, was the lead instigator of that, right? But broadly, they all went along with it. They all dragged their feet in being like, look, this is obviously a terrible idea. And I think, like, in terms of obviously Keir Starmer can say reasonably than he did last week, go, are you going to cancel it? Which, I mean, like, as crazy as this is to say in context, right, that was still quite a difficult thing politically to do, right? I mean, like, as we all know, right, you was quite a lonely position to be going, yeah, this is a bad idea. But that's been obvious since they first announced it, right? And I think, like, ultimately, and this to me is actually the real question mark around Keir Starmer's approach, is he enough of a gambler to successfully become prime minister? Because I do think sometimes you do have to, like, demonstrating leadership is partly about demonstrating a willingness to make tough and therefore sometimes risky calls. As I said, none of the risk stuff changed. I really think he ought to have come out and been like, Christmas, the unlocking, this obviously can't work. We shouldn't do it. The government needs to have a grown-up conversation about risk. I'll be spending it at Christmas time. Because there are lots of small things that you could have done. Additional support for people around bubbles to self-isolate if their family were further away and they'd want to turn up their local bubble. Just, yeah, like, there's just lots of things the government could have done, because some people will have needed to head home, right? Some of the people who headed home, you know, after the 2 a.m. will be doing so within the law because they will have an exemption under the guidelines. Whether they consciously know that or not, their case for doing so will have a guidance. So I think broadly, everyone has come out of this particularly poorly. The Conservative government, of course, has come out of this worse because, this problem is not a mystery. The coronavirus is a locomotive that runs on us.
Yeah. And also, it's sort of the little unglamorous things that aren't so little when you're, I know that now the plans have completely changed, but when they started getting worried about what they decided for over Christmas, they told people to self-isolate beforehand, which, like you pointed out, they haven't given them enough days even to do so. But also, they haven't given people means to do so, have they? So there's that very stingy statutory sick pay if, you know, you're even eligible for it, and also the lack of support for those self-isolating on top of that, which is, you know, for a public that has been very compliant, and you can see from the polling, the snap polling over the new Christmas rules, people are, you know, overwhelmingly on board with them. The bit of compliance that has been broken is people being instructed to self-isolate, according to some analysis of it. And that's mainly because people just cannot afford to do so. I've been reviewing a book by a GP for the next issue of the magazine who's written about his experience of this year. And he encounters patients who are feeling ill, who are saying to him, like we've heard from people who we've interviewed ourselves, well, I can't self-isolate. I'm on a 0 hours contract. I won't make any money. So those little policy tweaks that Labour, to be fair to them, have been really hammering home about, you know, since basically March, that they've just ignored. And I don't really understand why that is. You know, is it ideological? I don't understand it, because it would be part of one of the missing pieces of the government's sort of pandemic response jigsaw. Is that? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, good, because I'm going to, you know, incur the wrath of the NS's marketing team very sensibly, because I'm about to plug someone else's content. Please do subscribe to the New Statesman so that I'm not thrown out of an airlock. But actually, I think the article that everyone should really want to understand this is the interview that Rishi Sunak has done with The Spectator, where I do think this both shows, yeah, it's a key insight into Rishi's thought, which obviously is something I hope we've been providing all year. But also, I think does show that he is ultimately actually still a politician who is flawed and is at the beginning of his career and may never develop the skills not to do this, in which he literally explicitly says, if we're the high spending party, what's our dividing line with the Labour Party? And it's just like, I mean, that is, I was, yeah, a Conservative MP when it came out, because I put it in Morning Call's must reads, because I thought it was, you know, an essential piece that people should read to get a sense of his thinking. They were just like, why on earth have we literally said on the record that the reason why we're doing this cut is to have a dividing line with Labour? They were just like, insane. I think that this is the thing, is that, like, the thing that Rishi Sunak has resisted throughout is anything that he might have to keep afterwards. That's the reason for the free school meals resistance. It's the reason, because, like, once you go, oh wait, it turns out it's a social good if people can afford to stay home when they're ill, like, yeah, not just in within my own workplace, right? If you go to a shop, right, it's in your interest for the person behind the till to be able to afford to stay off if they're ill. And that holds for if they have the coronavirus or if they've just got a runny nose. Now, of course, there are compassionate reasons why that person, as an individual with rights and you know, the right to dignity and the pursuit of happiness, also deserves to be able to do those things. But I think a large part of why we've ended up in like a particularly poor position on isolation is a resistance to do anything permanent on sick pay that would be mm-hmm. difficult to unpick afterwards. And I think that is, you're right to say that is the main way that a government led by Keir Starmer would have handled it better.
Mm-hmm.
However, I mean, I do think, and obviously, yeah, like the opposition has called for sick pay stuff, but I do think one of the kind of the big missteps was not making sick pay their kind of their one big thing.
Yeah, like the flagship thing.
Yeah. Because like everything else is so bitty, right? Like central isolation, you suddenly start getting into like a abstruse argument about like, oh, what, are you going to put people in porter cabins? Are you going to bulk book out holiday inns? Like central isolation is really important, but it's just not something somewhere an opposition should be. But I just think that like, and this I think is where the like the sort of aversion to risk taking, mm-hmm. because it's safe. No one's ever going to point to the moment where you went, yes, let's do sick pay. Yes, there's a problem with procurement. Yes, there's a problem with this. Yes, you haven't done self-isolation. There is no criticism at an operational level that you cannot point to the relevant Labour shadow frontbencher and say they've made. The problem is that in of itself is one reason why they have not been heard. And they haven't used the like the main gun of the leader of the opposition, which in a situation where there's a majority of 86, right? Even I'm not going to write about the like minutiae of what like a shadow frontbencher has said.
Yeah,
I'm like the least cool person in political journalism. Like, but you know, it's just not newsworthy, right? Like, it just doesn't matter. You need to get the big gun being the one to say it, and everyone else needs to. You know, you can't have a situation in which, like, broadly, like, there's a welfare policy complaint, there's a Duchy of Lancaster complaint, and both those complaints are correct. It's just they should have focused on the welfare one.
Yeah, no, I think that's really true. And I suppose Marcus Rashford's campaigns each time on the free school meals and food poverty in general is an example of that, isn't it? Where obviously he's not a politician, but you have that sort of one drumbeat of a policy where everyone can understand it and everyone to an extent sort of has either directly or indirectly kind of experienced it because everyone's either been to school or have children in school. And you can really sort of, he's shown how you can really gain momentum around that by sort of being a big gun who a lot of people have heard of, making it very clear what you think the government should be doing. And I feel like Labour could probably learn a lesson from that along the lines of what you've been saying, you know, even to the detriment of maybe sacrificing quite so many different messages from each of the various shadow front benches. If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So instead of you ask us, I think we're going to try and cheer you all up by speaking about something a little bit more lighthearted. You'll probably remember, if you're loyal listeners, that we spoke early on in the original lockdown about how we were all getting through it. And so we're going to do that for the Christmas break now, because hopefully both of us will have a little time to rest over this period. It's Alva's birthday, so she has been spared even this section of the podcast. So Stephen, first of all, how many of your sort of hobbies and your coping mechanisms have survived since Easter?
I mean, so obviously quite a lot of them have been curtailed by the lockdown. So because during lockdown two, Arsenal forgot how to play football. So I'm not gaining any enjoyment from that hobby, even though that is obviously a hobby that has survived. As listeners will know, restaurants have been intermittently closed. So I've done a bit of that. The thing that this is like every week, I think I can't become more of a boring person live on air. Actually, the thing that I'm finding a bit unnerving is I've got really into tea. Because obviously you just like in the past, right, you didn't have a lot of agency over your tea, right? Someone in our lobby room in Westminster would get up and go, hey, do you want tea? Or, you know, you might yourself, if you're in our lobby room, please do not try and write in to expose the extent to which I was, you know, a free rider on the tea issue. And then you're just like, yeah, I like tea. I like it to kind of look, have that kind of like, you know, like sort of pale brown, you know, I'm very Southern, that kind of pale brown color. And that's basically about it. Right? But then suddenly you're at home, right? And you are the sole author of what the tea is, what type of tea it is. I mean, the other day I actually Googled whether or not I could get different cylinders for my little glass teapot so then the different teas wouldn't infect each other, because I've noticed that a slight lapsangy taste is starting to come into one of the teapots. And I've really started to develop opinions about, you know, how long the water should be in. Like, I've gone from being someone like, oh, it's fine. But like, to be honest, if the tea arrives and it's regular tea, I'm going to drink it. To someone who's just like, oh, well, you know, it's after 4 p.m. Time to switch to the broken orange Pekoe Assam, right? I've become a wine bore, but for tea, it's actually really kind of terrible when you think about it. It's just like another way that I've just become a very sad old man in lockdown. But yeah, what about you, Anoush? Have you?
I can't believe what I'm about to say on the back of you talking about tea, because I will also sound like a major bore. Basically, before this year, I never cycled in London. I never had a bike. I was too scared. Never even used a Boris bike. But I got a secondhand bike, promptly got it stolen, got another secondhand bike. And now I really love it. And my favourite thing is just to like tool around on it around where I live and tinker with it. And I got some new handlebar tape for it. And it's got to the stage where it was my birthday on the 30th of November. And what my main present, or the present that I loved the most from my partner, was a set of Allen keys. And his nickname for me now is Amiable Dad. Because all I do is just tinker around with my bike and like look at bike websites. So that's become my new hobby, which is a bit different from my gardening back in Easter, but both of them are equally tragic. Yeah, I haven't like started making electronic music or doing anything cool like some people I know. So yeah, sorry about that. But I really like the tea. I like the tea idea because I'm a big tea drinker and I've never ever got into coffee. And I feel like you're allowed to be a coffee connoisseur, aren't you, in life? But you're never really allowed to be fussy with tea. So I like that.
Yeah, it's because when you said the garden and both of them, I thought you were going to say that, like, both of your olives had died. And I was just going to be like...
My two olives. Both of my gardens. Yeah. We've actually got loads of olives. It's really weird. It's like a mutant sort of winter hardy olive tree.
But you are exactly right that being a coffee person is widely acceptable. And I think I find it really striking that you go to any town in the United Kingdom, right, and there'll be a fairly decent coffee shop, right? You know, like by historical standards, right? Even a Costa, you can get an okay cup of coffee. And yet tea, yeah, our national drink, the drink for which we like hooked one population on opium, enslaved another population, installed puppet leaders in a third. Yeah, like we made a lot of people shed blood for tea. And yet you go into any mainstream cafe and you get this kind of like this weird cup of tea where the bag has been barely introduced to the water. The milk is just...
It's like 2 week hot squash, but just with some tea dust. I hate it. Yeah. It makes me so angry. And then whenever I try and make a tea in a like keep cup or something, it just doesn't taste the same. That must be the cross-contamination flavours that you were talking about.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Actually, maybe I should just be loud and proud about the tea thing, because if I had said like in lockdown, oh, I've got into coffee, people would be like, oh, you're sophisticated. Isn't that like a thing George Clooney does, right? You know, those like weird little Nespresso things and are massively adding to our landfill or whatever. I think they have actually change that now, and it is more environmentally friendly. Please don't write in Nespresso people. But you say, oh, I've got really into different teas, and everyone's just like, patches on your elbows much?
Yeah, and wine as well. You're allowed to be a connoisseur about wine.
I'd always wish that like I understood more about wine, just because, you know, it would be useful.
Same. I don't know anything about wine or beer, which made it difficult when we used to. Do you remember we used to sometimes get beer either for the advent calendar reviews we did or for the adverts that we used to do on the podcast? And you'd have to be like, this small batch IPA is delicious and tastes different from Heineken to me.
Yeah, I think with beer, I also had this thing where for a prolonged period of time, I was just like, oh, maybe it's because I just don't know the right brand for me. And then I discovered Neck Oil.
Oh, I love Neck Oil.
Mm. Yeah, and I was like, oh, no, I really like this. And then some of my friends who actually do drink beer were just like, mate, this is not when you've discovered a beer that you like. This beer is like 2% proof. You do not like beer. You've just found like something so low alcohol, and it's not. But it's a really lovely beer, and I did always really struggle with the. Well, I mean, with Beer 52, I actually thought that was actually a genuinely, and this is why people should advertise with us, guys, because occasionally you get this extra free advert. That was something that I genuinely did like see the benefit of, not least because they sent you a little helpful booklet to be like, look, here are the flavors, here are the tasting notes. I mean, so like with lots of the beer advent calendars, one, like broadly, I think any alcoholic advent calendar has a problem that it falls between two stools, right? Actually, if you have to drink a different alcohol every day, or indeed if you just have a drink every day, you either start to feel pretty rubbish by like day six, you know, have that weird feeling where you feel like your body's gradually turning to paste, mm-hmm. and like you're just
skin
oh,
is like sort yeah. of secreting.
Yeah, you just like, you can just feel that your liver's just like, mate, please don't make me end you. Or if you're an alcoholic, right, it's not like there's very much in the calendar. There is no one for whom the amount of booze in a booze calendar is the optimal amount of alcohol. If you have a problem, you're going to just drink it on day one. If you don't have a problem, you're just going to wish that someone hadn't got you the calendar on day five.
Or hadn't sent you the calendar for free, which we were very grateful for, by the way.
Yes, sorry. Please do send us your free advent calendars next year, because this definitely won't happen again.
It has been a very weird year booze-wise, because obviously for us, for the nerds like us, we didn't have our party conference season, which is usually where I end up drinking more often, not more booze, but more often than I usually would, and then feeling kind of grey and gross on the train back at the end of it all. And also, like, the Christmas party period just hasn't existed. So I realised that I haven't really drunk anything. And it kind of made me nostalgic for the good times when the New Statesman team used to actually go and socialise sometimes, like our secret tequila bar that we used to have, and where you would always drink hilariously coloured drinks when everyone else had, like, a half pint.
Yeah, I can't remember when I suddenly was just like, do you know what, I'm just going to accept and I'm always going to have like the most effete drink out of the group, and I just don't care.
Like radioactive pink.
But like, this thing's ultimately like, we don't drink, well, so we do drink it because I have a massive sweet tooth and that like genetic predisposition to diabetes is doing all of its work, but like but you know, we also like scientists / people who make cocktails have experimented with pink drinks, and it's rude not to drink them. It's odd because I feel like there was a real period in lockdown one when I got into this like quite bad cycle of being like, it's the end of the day, how can I signal to my brain that it's the end of the day, oh, I know, wine. But I think overall, as you say, that I have probably ended up with a healthier level of intake because of the sort of weird conference thing where it's just like, hey, want to have a warm white wine and listen to someone talk about, you know,
cybersecurity.
Yeah, oh God, why is it always cybersecurity? Particularly actually last year, you know, and actually I do think some people who work on this for the SNP do listen to this podcast. So I'm just going to do some subliminal marketing here. Guys, next time you're planning, you know, where people should go, listen to your heart. What does your heart say? Glasgow, 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 Glasgow. It wouldn't take, if it went Aberdeen, you'd be like, oh my God, I've got an arrhythmic heart. I need to get that. It's this thing where you're just like, oh wow, these beautiful buildings. Oh, and then you're just in this conference center in the middle of nowhere, and you just end up, you know, eating like sort of like that weird, like expensive hotel food where you hand the receipt in at the NS and they're like, wow, you ate well. And you're like, no, no, not at all, actually, but ate appallingly badly.
You should be paying me. Luckily, I wasn't on the no sleep till Aberdeen tour, so I didn't have to endure that. But I do remember pictures of Patrick and Alva just looking absolutely knackered on that train.
God, I'm actually a terrible boss, aren't I? Because I point blank said that we couldn't take planes.
Fair play.
I would be lying if I said I wouldn't do it again. But I feel bad about the fact I'm lying when I wouldn't do it again. almost everything that went wrong. Thankfully, a number of very kind podcast listeners, when it looked like we might actually be stuck in Glasgow, which obviously in many ways would have been much better, obviously would have been unable to cover the conference from there. When it looked like we were going to be stuck in Glasgow, did kindly reach out and offer to put us up on their sofas. But there was a point when I was just looking at the two of them and they were so wet and bedraggled and the trains kept being cancelled. And I was just like, oh my God, this must be how, like, what's his fate? Oates. You know, one of those guys who got all of his men killed in the Antarctic. I was like, this must be how he felt. I've got them killed in the Antarctic.
Well, not there, I may be on this train for some time.
Yeah. God, it was, it's also just like, yeah, in the same way that, like, ultimately the Conservative Party needs to accept and they should never go to Manchester. Manchester doesn't like them being there.
Yeah.
I doubt they can enjoy being
there.
We
get spat on.
Yeah,
like, we're Tory members and we're not. Yeah, just look at my lanyard.
Yeah, it's just like, you're like, no one has a good time. It's just like, go to Birmingham, right? It's also a great city. It's also got great restaurants. Yes, the conference centre does have this slightly bizarre feeling that you're like doing it from an Escher painting, but just stay in Birmingham. Then Labour needs to just go back to doing Manchester and Liverpool rather than the like weird, endless walk to Brighton. Although, of course, I would take any of these places over conference panels where I zoom in from this flat.
Yeah, no, me too. I think that's probably quite a nice note to end our ramble on, because all of these memories just show that it is much better to be able to do stuff face to face than dial in and then one of your panelists is frozen and you ask your next question, but you're actually muted and everyone laughs at you and you want people to ask questions and you look in the chat and there are no questions.
Oh, God, yeah. If we weren't able to say to each other at Passover Seders this year and next year in person.
Yeah. Okay, well, have a lovely Christmas, Stephen. It's been nice doing these podcasts remotely so that I can hear another human voice in my week.
Yeah, and you have a lovely Christmas, you know, such as it is. It's been a great year. And also, like, thank you so much to all of our listeners, not just for liking and subscribing, although please do that. But, you know, the emails, the lovely notes in the You Ask Us, it's obviously been, as years go, not even a table wine. It's probably like one of those kind of like, actually, do you know what is overrated? Twinings.
Like, Twinings. That's, I was going to say Twinings. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a Twinings lapsang is what it is. But, you know, thank you so much, both for your kind of direct support of the podcast through subscribing to it and listening to it, for hopefully, if you can, to subscribing to The New Statesman, but also just because your messages have been a kind of continual sort of rock of sanity. And, of, you know, my apologies to those of you who also have disrupted Christmases. And yeah, and here's to, you know, here's hopefully to a better 2021, where whatever happens, at least we will, by the end of the year, be able to complain about it in person.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and my colleague, Stephen Bush. You can find me on Twitter at @Anoush_C.
You can follow me on Twitter at @StephenKB.
We're produced by Nick Hilton, and we have to say thank you to him for putting up with our internet connections and for getting us set up remotely for the whole year and also doubling the number of podcasts that we do. Our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. If you enjoyed the podcast, please leave us a review and make sure to subscribe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.